This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Teachers and administrators around the country face another set of federal benchmarks this school year, including, of course, No Child Left Behind. This law requires annual tests in reading and math in grades 3 through 8, and while debate continues about the value of standardized tests, ignoring them is not an option. Public schools that fail to meet the testing requirements risk losing funds, losing students, and often suffer a serious loss of morale. So what is the best way to get scores up and keep them up? Teaching to the test, class size, parental involvement, curriculum, tutoring, what works? Later in the program, how to craft a catchy city slogan. And we have an email challenge for you. If it happens in Sheboygan, it stays in Sheboygan. Send us a slogan to sell your city or the nation's capital. The address is TOTN at NPR.org. Again, that's TOTN at NPR.org. But first, what does it take to raise school test scores? If you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or student, give us a call. What's your school doing to try to raise their scores? What works? What doesn't? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address, same as the email challenge, TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now with an overview of what schools are facing is Claudio Sanchez, NPR's education correspondent. He joins us today from Studio 3A. Welcome, Claudio.
Thank you, Neil.
No Child Left Behind has been in effect for 2 years now. How are schools doing with test scores?
Well, leading up to the implementation of the law, there were roughly 9,000 schools that were deemed failing schools, many of them dating back to the mid-1990s.
9,000 out of how many?
Out of close to 90,000, so maybe 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since the law has passed, at least 4,300 schools have been added to that list. Of course, we have to realize that there are at least 20 states that have yet to figure out how to measure the success or the failure of schools. So many states have yet to submit lists of so-called failing schools. What's important to remember here is that the way in which the federal government now is measuring the failure of schools under a formula that's known as AYP, Adequate Yearly Progress, is a very complicated instrument and a very complicated law to begin with. But in essence, it measures the success of schools based on test scores, on reading and on math. The problem that schools are encountering is that depending on where you are in this country, the quality of instruction varies tremendously. So you've got many, many school systems that have had historically very low scores for all kinds of reasons, for the obvious reasons. Poverty, the concentration of poverty, not just poverty in and of itself. Schools that, for example, have upwards of 80% of children who are eligible for free lunch and so forth. And then there are schools that are considered successful that are now not looking so good because based on this very complicated formula of measuring successful schools, good schools, some of these schools have essentially been hiding behind their averages. Affluent suburban schools, for example, have on average done very, very well in this country before and since No Child Left Behind. But because the law requires that schools break down their test scores in reading and math by race, ethnicity, income, disability, there are many, many successful, quote, successful schools that are not educating or are not getting these other subgroups up to par. And therefore, you've got very successful schools looking very poorly. Virginia, California, and other states have complained bitterly about somehow being described as failing schools when, in fact, their schools, by all accounts, certainly by parents, in parents' views, are very successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, in all of this, you mentioned that there are a fair number of states that haven't figured out how to test their or evaluate their tests yet. But there, we should point out, we're talking about No Child Left Behind because it's a federal standard, but there are all kinds of these standardized tests that are applied in different ways in a lot of different states as well.
Exactly. What the law says precisely is that every state can pick the standard or the testing that it wants. But then it dictates in excruciating detail who should be tested, what should be tested, and essentially how that's reported. And that obviously is what creates this problem of reality and perception as far as how good these schools really are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should also mention that you know, it's very early, really. 2 years is not a long time for us to really gauge how this nation as a whole is doing, how much improvement there has been. One clear example, though, is that what this law has created is an impetus. It has taken from the last 10 to 15 years of school reform perhaps the most important feature of school reform, and that is accountability. Who do we hold accountable when a school fails?
And who holds them accountable? In this case, schools were always a local issue, community issue, state issue. It's now a federal issue.
More so than ever. I think we could go back to 1965, really, to see the most expansive role that the federal government ever took. But again, it was back when the focus was on poor children. It was really compensatory, what was called compensatory education, to make up for what the states were lacking or not doing. Now, this law is saying, and it's again, it's a very sweeping law, it's saying every single school system, every single child in those systems has to achieve, and that by 2014, every child should be reading or doing math at the proficient level, 100% of all these children. If you look at some of the projections out there in states like Texas, California, Connecticut, from small to large states, some of the research is showing that very few of these states, even those that have gone very far in raising standards and so forth, are on track to reach that goal. Mm-hmm. By 2014, by some accounts, California schools, which is established in pretty high standards by some accounts, California schools, 95% would not meet that goal.
Well, let's talk about the 2004-2005 school year just for a minute. You've reported on several schools that are working to improve their scores. Listeners may have heard your reports on the Morning Edition. For instance, 75% of public schools in Philadelphia improved significantly on the state's reading and math tests. What worked in Philadelphia?
It's a combination of things. And in fact, you alluded to many of these in your opening. Keep in mind that in some of these schools, and again, Philadelphia, considered for many, many years one of the most low-achieving, most troubled school systems in the country, in some cases, the increases in Philadelphia were stunning. 42, 35, 22 percentage points in math among fifth graders, for example. Same story in reading. Whites, Latinos, African-American students all made huge gains. The black-white gap in math has narrowed in that city, which is a huge accomplishment, although it's still big. And 160 schools in the city out of the 264 or so are now meeting what the federal government describes as adequate yearly progress. The head of the Philadelphia Public Schools, Paul Vallis, who's credited with saving Chicago's public schools, took over that system a couple of years ago. And he says that the gains are due in large part to his school improvement plan. And that it's not a magic bullet, but on the other hand, it is so simple, it's almost obvious. The one thing that every school in that system has done is follow that plan. And that plan consists of a standardized curriculum in reading, math, science, social studies. Everybody is literally on the same page, a huge change from 3 or 4 years ago when in every classroom literally was doing something different. I mean, in many school systems these days, you have classrooms right next to each other where the teachers are teaching from a different textbook. And they're teaching very different standards, and they're often just deviating entirely from a central core standard or a central set of standards. Mm-hmm. And that's changed in Philadelphia, and it's gone a long ways in creating this more even implementation of what's considered a very rigorous curriculum. Then there's the extensive tutoring. Unlike most cities, Philadelphia today is providing an enormous amount of tutoring for the kids who need it the most. Then there's small class size, an expensive proposition, but Philadelphia has put some serious money into that, reducing the ratio of the teacher-child mm-hmm. so that you have more nurturing and more individualized attention. And then there's an incredible amount of teacher training that's going on. Teacher training has become really the vehicle with which you not only convey or at least get all teachers on page, but where you get them to buy into this whole enormous effort. Because if you have disparate, you know, teaching, a teacher corps that is divided, that is fighting against these changes, then you might as well throw in the towel, because in the end, it's these teachers that are imparting the quality of instruction.
All right, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Diane joins us from Moultrie, Georgia.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Diane.
I'm a teacher, and I work with several different schools in the area of instructional technology. First of all, I have nothing against testing, really, and I love standardized curriculum. We have made tremendous gains here in Georgia when I look at all the things you just mentioned in your discussion. The thing that scares me a little is the things we've taken out of the curriculum to focus on the test scores. You know, social studies and science seems to be really suffering, and those are the things that interest children and that really matter, the geography and those kind of subjects. What can we do to keep those keep focused on those real life kind of skills at the same time that we raise the test scores?
Teaching to the test, absorbing too much time, Claudia. Diane's hardly the only person to raise this issue.
And it's a legitimate issue to raise. I find that the big difference in the views of folks about this is often an issue of class. It's often an issue of geography. If you look at inner city schools and look at just how low and how poor performing they have been in reading and math, you wonder, what else can you do other than to focus on these two major important areas? Many reformers in large cities, for example, like Philadelphia, say we can only do so much in the amount of time we have to do it. And if we raise expectations, if we raise the quality of the curriculum, and if we raise the performance of these children in at least these two areas, math and reading, then it's a start. And yet when you go to suburban Columbus, when you go to suburban Los Angeles or suburban Detroit in some of the more high-achieving school systems, you find this complaint clearly that by holding all schools to this more rigorous attempt to raise levels of math and reading achievement, you are losing something. Many states have had to cut back in many areas, and guess where they're cutting? They're cutting in the arts, they're cutting in extracurricular activities, and they're forcing parents really to look at this as a zero-sum game for many school systems. I mean, you gain in some areas, but boy, do you lose a lot in others.
And Diane, thank you very much for the call, by the way. But a lot of those issues that you mentioned in Philadelphia due to responsible for their improvement in performance on these tests, well, tutoring, smaller class size, teacher training, that's all money one way or another.
That's right. And, one of the things that I think to some degree the misleading debate over the money issue has been that, of course, the Bush administration has not put enough money into this law. And yes, there's evidence that it's about $9 billion, if not more, dollars short, because the Congress authorized that much more, and yet the money isn't there. It's more money than, elementary and secondary education has ever gotten from the federal government by the Bush administration account, 49% more than the Clinton administration ever put in. But what this has really exposed is just how unfair and how scandalous the funding of public education is, because in the end, 80 to 85, 90% of the funding for schools comes from states. And every single state has a different formula. And every one of those formulas is flawed, because so much of what schools get from, in terms of money, relies on property taxes. And guess what? Property taxes are the most uneven, most regressive way of funding schools. And yet that's the foundation upon we are financing public education these days. And again, this law has exposed just the unfairness of that as a source for public schools.
We're talking with NPR education correspondent Claudio Sanchez about what's the best way to, now that those tests have been ensconced in federal law, what's the best way to get scores up and keep them up? What's going on at your school? What works? What doesn't? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Don't forget our email challenge for later in the program. All those snazzy city slogans, give us one for your town or maybe one for Washington, D.C. totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about schools and what we've learned about what can be done to raise test scores and keep those scores up. What's your school doing to try to improve its standardized test scoring results? Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. The email address is totn at npr.org. Claudio Sanchez, NPR's education correspondent, is with us here in Studio 3A. Joining us now to explain how schools can move from just good to excellent is Judith Langer, the author of Getting to Excellent, How to Create Better Schools. She's a professor at the University, State University. Is this SUNY Albany that you're a professor at?
It is SUNY Albany, that's right.
State University of New York at Albany. She joins us now from our bureau in New York City. Good of you to be with us today.
Pleased to be here, Neil.
Briefly tell us how you did your study. What kind of schools were you looking at?
Well, about 6 or 7 years ago, I began a study because I was very concerned with the situation that parents, teachers, administrators, and even policymakers found themselves in. Everybody wanting students to do better in tests, whether they approved of the tests or not, and looking for guidance. And so what I did was set up a large-scale study comparing a variety of types of schools, urban, suburban, rural, those with high poverty, those with students who are better off financially. I matched high-performing schools with more typically performing ones and with comparable demographics. And I'd studied each of the schools for 2 years each. What I was interested in is what happens in the lives of educators and in the lives of the parents and community vis-a-vis the school, as well as what the students are experiencing in school that helps students learn better in schools that, over a long period of time, do better.
And what works?
I have three different broad findings that I'm going to tell you about today. And what's so very interesting is that although all the schools I studied tried hard, and I was in a number of states studying these schools that do better, whatever student body they serve, are dramatically different from the less successful ones in ways we don't ordinarily expect. They are more collaborative, they're more professionally engaged, they're more connected to their community, and they're more in touch with their times than those that don't do as well. And I'm going to give you three big areas that I'm going to talk about. One is that they respond to high-stakes tests in very different ways. The second is that they offer different kinds of instruction. And the third is that their notions of parent and community involvement are all different. Overall, the ways in which they interact about the tests, what they think of the tests and how they respond to them, the tests, are dramatically different. Also, they all think that students can learn in the higher performing schools, and it's their job to make it happen. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you how they respond to the high stakes tests first.
That's what we're focusing on, so why don't you go ahead with that?
Yeah. That's number one. Whether they approve of them or not, the more successful schools treat the high stakes tests as an opportunity. They use it as a time to inspect and fine-tune their curriculum and to enrich it. They integrate the kinds of knowledge and skills the students need to know in their coursework throughout the entire year so that there's a connecting and a compounding of knowledge in varied and interesting ways. Therefore, they take a broad view of what it means to get ready for tests or what it means to learn. In comparison, in response to the high-stakes tests, the more typical schools narrow the curriculum to what gets tested, and they spend more and more of the class time preparing for the particular tests. So one example would be in one state, one of the writing tests, one of the language arts and writing tests, asked students to do persuasive writing, write an essay trying to persuade people to do something. And they practiced very hard on the test in some schools throughout the entire year. And others took this as an opportunity, a broader opportunity, to help the students learn that there are various purposes for writing and that writing for persuasion is only one of them, but there are lots of others. Hmm. Everybody did a little bit better the first year, and even a little bit better the second year. But by the third year, you saw a leveling off of the schools that were simply focusing on the test itself. And more than that, when the state changed to a different kind of writing, the students who had started to do better in persuasive writing but only had that obviously fell dramatically. So for the long-term gain, you can't just prepare for the test itself. You have to deal with the test in a broader sense.
And it sounds like your prescription is almost the classical liberal education. We need a broad education to teach a wide number, to teach kids how to think.
Well, there's no doubt that the more successful schools enrich the students, give them more to think about it in a broader sense, and the others don't. But it has nothing to do with the fact that you have more progressive schools or more traditional schools. Some of the very, very traditional-oriented schools, in fact, follow the very same principle that I'm describing.
Well, let me bring Claudio Sanchez back into this. Claudio, you visited schools not just in Philadelphia, we were talking about earlier, but Miami, Baltimore, a number of other places.
Los Angeles included. I mean, what I find is that in the trenches, certainly among administrators who, as has been pointed out, I mean, people who may hate the test but think that this might be an opportunity. Philadelphia, for example, kids are tested there every 6 weeks. What I find interesting there is, though, that the tests, rather than being used as a hammer with which to say, look, you teachers are doing a horrible job, or you, the kids, are a bunch of dummies, that the test really is an opportunity for the teacher to diagnose what the problem is, to pinpoint. I mean, that's why it's done so often. And yes, you could argue that this is taking away time from other things, certainly enrichment and so forth, or a more well-rounded education. But what it's allowing schools to do, and certainly principals and teachers, is to pinpoint exactly which kids are behind, what to do, how much tutoring to expose this kid to, and hopefully for this kid to do better later. Mm-hmm. It's simply a way to get at the most important issue here, and that is, how do you change the minds of both teachers and kids that they can achieve? And I think that's been one of the underlying issues in American public education, that some kids can't, some kids can.
Judith Langer, I was interested in your book. You write, after 5 years study of all these, 88 different schools, you say that you could, after all that experience, you could walk into a school and immediately tell by looking at it, or looking at a few special things, whether it was doing well or not.
One of the critical features is what I call minds on learning. The moment you walk into a school, you have a sense that the students and the teachers are minds on. They're not only focusing on the content that needs to be taught, but on how the students are thinking about the material. And the teachers use the content as a way to help students explore new knowledge and interesting and related concepts, to develop deeper and potentially more useful understandings. And that's the knowledge that sticks with them. It gets them through the tests well, but more than that, it holds them in good stead for the remainder of their school years and the rest of their lives. In comparison, the more typical schools focus on the content alone, not on how the students are thinking about it. So again, they might get short-term results, but very short-term, and those kinds of learnings are often soon forgotten.
Well, let's get another caller in on the conversation, and let's talk with Lisa. Lisa's calling from Bend, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, and I agree with Dr. Langer. I think that we need to really look at what is going to help our students become lifelong learners and become passionate about education. And standardized testing, while it's not going away, it very rarely has that effect on students. They are not passionate. When teachers are preparing for the tests, they are very rarely helping students to really find their passions and connect with the material in a way that is going to keep them engaged in learning for years to come once they get out of schools. And I would also like to make a comment. I have found that many schools, while they say that they use the standardized tests as diagnostic tools, that often doesn't happen. Students who do poorly on these tests, the tests are not used to help them, to help the teachers create new programs or to look at these students and to try and find ways to really help them. They're just pooled into a database of scores, and the students are still in the same arena that they were in before they took the tests.
Is that right, Claudio?
Well, you know, what I find is that I think maybe one of the issues that this raises in terms of the testing that's going on, it's first of all a mistake to think that every single state has the same tests, let alone the same quality. Every single state has different tests. Some have developed very high, rigorous, high-quality tests that have been very expensive to produce, that are matched with very high standards. Other states are doing it on the cheap. I mean, some tests have been put together for as little as $2 a child. And I think that, on average, the good quality tests cost a lot more than that. So, first of all, the high quality tests that I think very few people would take issue with in terms of how much it really does gauge a child's overall knowledge, and at least it allows us to know whether that child knows enough or knows what he should know or she should know and be able to do. I mean, I don't think there's any argument that we should know or be able to know what these children are learning in school. And testing, whether we like it or not, is often the best or the only instrument with which to do that. Every state, however, has a decision to make. And unfortunately, too many states have really settled for very inferior, very low-quality testing. Mm-hmm. And that often is what leads to this sense that the testing is not only bad, but that the testing isn't telling us anything, and that the testing, in fact, may be hurting this child. Because if you look across the state line or across the country and look at how kids are achieving and what they're doing in really good, rigorous schools, and then look at how your child is doing under a testing regimen that is very poor quality, then of course you're going to come away with a sense that your child's being cheated. And again, it all comes down to how much states are investing in the quality of tests. Paul Vallis up in Philadelphia will be very quick to tell you, I don't mind teaching to the test as long as I know or I'm confident that that test is testing the right things and is fair and it's being used to diagnose or to at least tell us where that child is.
As you went around the country, Judith Langer, did you see this disparate quality of the testing?
Well, there's no question that tests are quite disparate across the country. But I think at this point, the question is less what the particular test is than how they're used and how they're being responded to. No test can be the sole indicator of a student's performance. And more research is showing that what we need are multiple indicators, including some notion of how the student is doing in the classroom before making major decisions about the student's ability or knowledge in a particular subject area. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, it's how the tests are being used. If they're being used in ways that create a broader knowledge base. What does it take to do well on these tests and in the coursework that we're teaching our students? If that is the definition of what it means to understand and practice for tests, then my studies show that those are the places where students not only do better across the board, all kinds of students, but over longer periods of time.
Lisa, thanks very much for the phone call. And we'd like to thank Judith Langer for her time today. She's the author of the new book, Getting to Excellent, How to Create Better Schools, and she's a professor of education at the State University of New York at Albany. I got it right that time. Thanks very
you
much
sure
for being
did.
With us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now to share how one school went from low performing to high growth in just 1 year is Diane Campbell, Director of Research and Accountability for Rockingham County Schools in North Carolina. She's with us by phone from her office. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
One of the schools in your county, Reidsville High School, went from low performing to high growth this year. How come?
Well, we had a lot of strategies that we put in place, which are strategies we use system-wide, starting with the school improvement plan that is based on the North Carolina Standard Course of Study, and which is backed by our test data. Those guides tell teachers objectives that need to be covered, resources they can use, and suggested strategies. And in a state where we are recruiting lots and lots of new teachers, that's a very important component to success. We've also stressed workshops on lesson planning. Do we have effective lesson plans? Is the amount of time that you're putting on a task appropriate for that level? We've looked at differentiated instructional techniques, We're looking at reading in the content area, which is addresses the question on science and social studies, because you can teach reading in science and social studies or in art and vocational subjects. We're also bringing in the piece on how to bring in our parents and community involvement by bringing in the initiative of communities and schools, where businesses form a partnership with the school. They give us tutors their time, or they may give us materials or money, whichever that suits them.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but all of this seems to be wonderful stuff. None of it seems to be rocket science. Why did it only get applied to Reidsville High School last year?
Well, it did not just apply last year. We have been working on these initiatives in our system for quite a few years, but each year we get a little better and better at what we do. We get a little smarter and smarter. We get a little more intense with the level that we are carrying that out also.
So it was the concentration of all this activity that moved that one school from low performing to high growth.
Absolutely.
Okay, so it finally, accumulated effect finally had, the rock started rolling uphill, if you would.
Absolutely, because change doesn't happen in one year.
Absolutely. A hard part, some people say, isn't raising those scores, it's maintaining them.
Absolutely, and that is the hardest part. So you have to look back at what did your data tell you, what are my next steps, using data as my decision tool.
Diane Campbell, congratulations on the improved performances there, and good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Diane Campbell is Director of Research and Accountability for Rockingham County Schools in North Carolina, and she joined us on the phone from her office. And Claudia, let me wind up with this email that we got from Mark Wilson. The problem, he writes, with standardized tests is they don't compare children's progress against their previous knowledge, but against their peers from previous years. If you have a particularly successful class one year, it's harder for students in the following years to show progress. Again, part of the improvement, maybe in North Carolina or in Philadelphia, means starting from a very low base. Once you move up, it's really hard to keep it going.
That's very true. And to this day, even though Philadelphia has shown pretty remarkable progress in a year, year and a half, the fact is that very few cities, very few school systems have been able to maintain high test scores for any meaningful amount of time. One reason for that, though, is that public education reform has been so trendy, so gimmicky. Very little innovation is given time to work. And we're looking at really a 10 to 15-year process before we really know whether it works. I mean, look at the reading wars. Look at the math wars. Look at all these things that have divided us about how or which direction we should go and how we have settled for one thing and then all of a sudden changed and done another.
Claudio Sanchez, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Claudio Sanchez is NPR's education correspondent here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, a new edgy and unofficial slogan for Houston is gaining steam on the internet. What's your city's slogan? Back after a break, NPR News.